Ready to unlock the secrets to a thriving career in the pharmaceutical industry? I'm Lizzie, your guide to navigating the ins and outs of pharma professions. Tune in for expert interviews, insider tips, and the strategies you need to break into this dynamic field. Welcome to Cracking the Code, Pharmaceutical Industry Careers, where your journey begins. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm very excited because tonight's guest is a bit different from my usual guest, just a bit of a different career background. So I'm joined by Mark Jordan. Hi, Mark. How are you going?
Good, thanks, Lily. How are you?
Yeah, good. Not too bad. So Mark previously worked as a paramedic for a number of years, and then he made a transition into sales, and more specifically as a GP sales rep at DKSH. Now, of course, we'll dive a bit more into why that was, but my first question is, why did you want to become a paramedic?
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me first up. I've always, ever since a young age, my mum is actually a paramedic and my dad was a police officer. So I was always around emergency services and what it entailed to be in emergency services with shift work, etc. And I was always fascinated by the stories, by the training, the things that my mum could do and my dad could do. I saw my mum help people countless times when I was young and playing sports and people were injured and they'd go looking for my mum immediately, and I just had a lot of pride in that. You know, most sons follow their fathers, and pretty proud to follow my mother, to be honest. I had more of a, I was sort of gravitated far more towards the human body, biomechanics and human movement and things like that. It just became a big passion of mine. And I went into the fitness realm. I did some time as a personal trainer and in gyms, and then once we sort of got a name for ourselves, myself and a business partner went out on our own to start a pretty successful large gym that he's still running and has, and it just got me more and more into biomechanics, human movement. I started to look at physiotherapy and things, but I found it very tedious, you know, working with somebody for such a long period of time for what I saw as minor improvements. Whilst it's fantastic, don't get me wrong, and it's a noble profession, it wasn't for me. I wanted something a bit more fast-paced, but still the human body, and I loved helping people and always have, and so it led me to look further into what mum was doing and then what I really wanted to do.
Great. And what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced as a paramedic?
It's funny. You always get you tell people what you do for a living, and sometimes people don't believe me. They'll think I'm a tradie or a salesman, and funny enough, now I am the latter of the two. But everyone wants to know what the biggest, glorious, baddest job you've ever done was. And don't get me wrong, those things will stick in your head and you'll remember seeing some things forever. But it's more the difficulties in the psychosocial aspect for me, where it was a struggling family or an upset family, were difficult. But then with the parts of the job that you've got to sacrifice, it's very long hours. You've got to be up early in there at your car, signing out government medications and checking your car to make sure that all your stocks are full and all that sort of thing. So you're there, you know, half an hour before your shift starts. Then you're in the car for 12 hours. But if somebody calls 5 minutes before you're supposed to finish, you've got to go. And that could push your end finish time hours later. You never get a lunch break. You never get time to stop because it's just call after call after call. And the shift work's tough because you work on a non-week rotating roster, night shifts, afternoon shifts, day shifts. So hobbies, social life, family life, any sort of routine, even sleep routines, everything like that goes out the window because it's just almost impossible to maintain them.
So
that was a strain. Remuneration, to be honest, some people in the world think that paramedics get paid an exorbitant amount of money. We get paid very, very poorly, and that's made up for a little bit of weekend work, night work, constant overtime. So remuneration is a very, very tough one, and we're overworked with the number of staff that we should really have on road at a time. You just never get a single bit of downtime.
Yeah. No, I can imagine. Did you ever get called out to certain situations that really did not require a paramedic?
So funnily enough, 90% of our work these days is exactly that. And that's one really, really tough thing that we face is the general public's health literacy is really quite poor. And you find that on a daily basis. And it's frustrating to constantly maintain a sort of brave face and a happy face and deal with the patient as appropriately and respectfully as you can, because it might be your daughter's birthday, it might be Christmas Day or anything like that, and you want to get home, but you called to someone that kicked their toe 3 weeks ago and they're calling for an ambulance today. I still remember some of the funniest calls that I got. I was called to a 25-year-old female that lived across the road from the hospital that had a sore pimple on the back of her neck.
No way.
Yep, I got called to a 40-year-old lady who was sweating, sitting outside on a 45-degree day out in the sun.
And called an ambulance. Wow.
Yep. Well, I got called. We were just about to finish a really tough block of shifts. We had some bad jobs, and we were supposed to finish at 6 a.m. We're nearly back to station, because once you get to station, they can't call you out again. We're nearly back there, and we get a call an hour away, because we were the closest car, to a lady that woke up from a bad dream and her heart was racing, so she just wanted us to check her heart rate and her blood pressure and then let us go on our way. But we have to go with a smiling face because at the end of the day, you don't know if something is wrong, so you've got to go and make sure that that's appropriately not destined for hospital and not the differential diagnosis doesn't require emergency medicine. That's it. But unfortunately, you get that constantly on a daily basis. Paramedics are out there doing 10 jobs a day, and maybe two of them need to go to hospital.
I can just imagine how taxing that would be every day and over time. Yeah. You know, you did it for a number of years and being called to things like that. That's a great sort of introduction to my next question, which is what role do you think community education and awareness around someone's health in general could play in improving emergency response outcomes? And this question stems a lot from our job with treating, promoting a product that treats chronic lung disease. And I see it all the time that doctors, and we've got strong stats that show that there isn't enough patient education around their disease, and that results in chronic lung disease being one of the biggest preventable hospitalizations in Australia, and it's all down to patients recognizing when they're flaring up and what's really serious, what's not so serious, and reaching out to the doctors. But that sort of education and awareness takes time. I'll repeat the question because I did a bit of stacking there. So what role does community education and awareness play in improving that emergency response to try and reduce those unnecessary calls to paramedics?
It's a really good question that you put up, Lizzie, a really good point to be made that it needs to be looked at further. Unfortunately, on one hand, you're dealing with a service that should be treating acute illness and injury and trauma, and another one that's treating chronic illness. Doctors are seeing patients for a long time over years treating these sort of chronic conditions, and one is to treat acute sort of traumatic events. And that's the sort of thing that I suppose needs to firstly be differentiated and identified: what is an emergency versus what is not, what is an acute episode versus what is not. Community participation, literacy, education could be far more beneficial, could be far more broadly offered, and would make such a difference to both aspects. So if you think about why we don't have constant first aid courses or that sort of level of training in our schools, like why not have that as just a mandatory program so that everyone's qualified or everybody understands it's not something that we get taught. It's difficult, don't get me wrong. People have to want to do it, and people have to have the understanding and a little bit of sort of common sense with a lot of things, which can be difficult. I ran a few community programs. I got sent out regionally with paramedicine. In the first few years, you can be sent wherever and you've just got to go. So I went to a town called Boggabri, which is an hour and a half northwest of Tamworth, 8 hours from my family, for a period of time. And it ended up being very insightful. And I started a community-based program every Tuesday, because out there you do get a bit of downtime because there's not as many jobs during the day, but you'll be on call the whole time because there's some at night or it's hours away from hospitals. And so when you do get a job, it might go for 6 hours. So in our downtime, I set up a community program to help educate how to manage emergencies or what to do in an emergency, because people just don't understand. They've never been taught because they've never been given the opportunity. So I dealt with at the community centre with a lot of the elderly population just to explain to them, when you do call for an ambulance, try to have your current medical history. I'm not worried that you broke your femur when you were 16 in 1942. Like, that's cool. I don't need to know. It's more relevant medical history. If you have medications, have them out, like your Webster pack. And sort of anything that sort of led up to the current situation, you know, what were you doing, what did you feel, that sort of thing, and any information we can get around anything that's happened recently. And giving that education, it really changes people's perspective as to what is and isn't an emergency. And that's just not offered in a lot of places. You look at the our ability to even obtain AEDs around, like in the community at the moment, there's not many, and people don't know how to use them or don't know what to do in an emergency. People don't know what the appropriate actions are because they've never been taught. We deal with a very large portion of socioeconomically disadvantaged people as well. So mental health is on the rise more these days than, say, trauma. And that is tough because whilst they not need to go, everyone always has to err on the side of caution because we live in such a litigious society. So New South Wales Health is such a huge, broad network, but everyone has to be seen to be doing the right things for their individual business. So this person does this to cover them, but then this person makes this decision to cover them, and this person does this to cover themselves, and it ends up just being so many holes in the bucket that you can't, where do you plug?
So,
unfortunately, a lot more can be done, but it's who funds it, who's going to do it, who's going to put their hand up to want to have it.
And it takes time to put all these things in place.
Exactly right.
And people, sadly, the biggest decision is where the buck lies. You know, it's down to money as well.
Exactly. And the thing I find so often for doctors as well is people want to be seen to and cured immediately. Like we get called, I've been called to people that have had the flu, and then explain to them, like, you know, this isn't a job for an emergency service. This is your doctor. You need to see a doctor about this. I have been to my doctor. Okay, excellent. Did you get antibiotics? I did. Have you taken your course? Yeah, I started them this morning. So they've been to the doctor that morning. They still have the flu in the afternoon and wonder why they're not cured, so I want to go to hospital. So there is obviously some sort of breakdown of communication or the knowledge that the person you assume would have that sort of underlying health literacy, and they don't. Is that their fault? No, they just probably haven't been offered to it. But then not only are we getting that call, the doctor's getting that person returned to their practice, and that's just one patient, and they have 427 different chronic disease states they have to try and be across that leads to numerous amounts of patients. So they're not only bombarded each and every day with people wanting a solution, most people coming back wondering why they're not cured within a day. So it's just a repetitive constant bombardment of huge amounts of numbers of people and just not enough people to facilitate the service.
And then on top of that, they get reps like us who are trying to see them for just 30 seconds, please.
I feel like that whole landscape has changed as well. Like this farm, I can't believe moving into this role how educated the people are, like my colleagues. They have PhDs, they have masters. These are very well educated people, honestly, wanting to help. But then you put Netflix on and there's a horrible sort of fictional program of reps and the things that they go to and the lengths that they go to in order to get a sale. And then people assume that that's how we get paid, is by all the drugs in our boot that doesn't actually exist in any way, shape or form.
No, that's not how it works anymore. Well, not for this gig anyway. Yeah. That's leading on to my next question. What led you to become a sales rep for DKSH?
Look, unfortunately for me, I was loving paramedicine, and we never go into situations knowing what situation we're going into. You get a little bit of information on a tiny screen that gives you as much information as the call taker was able to ascertain or obtain from the patient or a bystander, and that's all we have to go on. You don't necessarily know the environment you're going into, you don't know the nature of the person that you're going to see, you don't know the mental capacity of the person that you're going to treat. It's all just done when you get there. I got called to a job one night, or early in the hours of the morning. The patient, all on the screen was patient said that they were dying, and then the phone was disconnected. So to us, it's treated as a high priority. We go lights and sirens, not to every job, and off we went. We got to the house, and it was difficult access. It was a group home, tiny little corridors. If we have jobs where it's difficult to extricate a patient, we either call for a backup crew or for fireys because they have more people in the car and more equipment. And this particular individual was severely overweight, and when we finally gained access, we realised he was just heavily intoxicated. Now, still a concern. He's severely intoxicated. He's passed out and incoherent with a little bit of vomit. We've got to treat that seriously. We don't want anything to happen to him, so we'll still do the right thing and take him out of hospital. Only way to get him out is these carry chairs that we have with wheels, and we went to wheel the gentleman out, and he was came to, got a bit aggressive, and shook his chair and went to throw himself down some stairs. I've just instinctively grabbed the banister, left out, and I've caught him with one hand, screamed, not knowing at the time what happened, until my partner come and help me. Yeah, long story short, I ended up with a completely ruptured bicep and a torn rotator cuff. And it's a bit, it wasn't fun. And then, unfortunately, within the realms of paramedicine, you have to be completely cleared. There can't be any questions as to your capacity because, we live in such a litigious society. If something were to go wrong and people ask questions, you'd be put under the microscope as if you're effective in your role. And some of the troubles and some of the difficulties we go through as paramedics is sometimes the support that we get. I had to sit in limbo while people didn't really give the support I needed. I had to wait for approval for surgery for 9.5 months. So I wasn't allowed to work. I had to sit at home for 9.5 months before I even got approved for surgery. And then it was a 12-month recovery process.
Wow. Okay. Why is it so long?
It's just not the right people talking to the other right people to do the right things, and insurance companies wanting you to jump through all the hoops, and then you go see their specialist as well for a second opinion, and that he was one of the most rudest, malpractice, inefficient, ineffective people I've ever met in my life. The things that he said to me about how much he didn't care and he's not even going to bother looking at scans. He turned around and his diagnosis for a completely ruptured bicep and torn rotator cuff that were confirmed with MRIs and from other professionals, he said 6 weeks of physio and a cortisone injection was his recommendation. So he went inflammatory and some physio. And so
you didn't pick him.
The level of treatment that you got. And then it ended up all going well. However, I'm not someone that can sit idly by. I've got two young daughters, and when you're on work, come you go to base wage, you also need to be mentally active, physically active. You need to be, I need to be doing things. And so home life was getting a bit difficult. And I sat down with my partner who got me through most of it. And she was like, why don't you look at what your skills consolidate to do? So we sat and we started to look, and the role that I applied for popped up and it sounded super interesting. And I was like, why not? So many times in my life, people have thought I was a tradie or a salesman. So let's have a look into this. But it lined up perfectly because I got to still, keep the patient at the center and be around medicine and be around doctors. And so it just sounded too good to be true.
So what do you like about this role? You probably hinted at two things there, still having the patient at the forefront of what we do.
I think this role really gets a bad rap, as I said earlier, because of Hollywood and people's perception about what it is that we do and how we actually obtain our own salaries and things like that. What I love about it is just the sheer volume of people that I'm surrounded by that are so diverse in whether it's their background, whether it's their way that they got into the job, their study, their training. People are so intelligent and so many amazing degrees and efforts to get there. You learn so much. You get to learn so much pathophysiology and the pharmacodynamics and kinetics of medications and the human body, and you still get to deal with doctors. And I love talking and building programs and trying to help people. So getting to actually go out there and sit there in a meeting and talk about these awesome things that you can do to help patients, and you're literally just sitting there having lunch with a doctor and trying to really generate some change, It's fantastic. It's really, really good.
Through your GP rep role, I guess now you get two perspectives of treating a patient and the challenges GPs are faced with, and also what paramedics are faced with. Do you think they differ in any way? And if so, how?
Yeah, I think so. It's funny, when I used to rock up to, we get called to doctor surgeries quite often for emergencies that they may not have the capacity to deal with. And they roll out a red carpet when you're rocking up in an ambulance in a uniform. But when I go as a sales rep, unfortunately,
not quite the same response.
Yeah, exactly right. Sometimes they don't even look up before they say no. So that's really quite difficult. But I understand it a lot more. We face the same challenges, just the sheer overwhelming number of patients, as well as not enough people to facilitate that service. There's not enough doctors, there's not enough paramedics, the sheer volume of patients out there. Remuneration can be difficult, the time and the hours that they need to put in. all taken up by trying to be productive for the bottom line of treating patients. So I get why it's difficult to see us. I can understand, if they just gave us that 30 seconds and they would really show that we had something to offer and that we actually cared would be different. But I think, like all jobs, you know what I mean? Like sometimes it's just understaffed, underfunded, and just the service you try to provide is just diluted because of the sheer volume of service you've got to try to provide. So I have I empathise with them. I don't get disheartened by the doctor's inability to see me at all, because I can really understand that sort of system that they're stuck in as well. It's more I sort of get more affected, I suppose, by the receptionist not even looking up or even wanting to let me speak is quite disheartening, and I sometimes take personally, I guess.
You have actually got some exciting news, good and bad, for the DKSH team. So would you like to share, and this is probably the first time you're announcing it, because you haven't put it on LinkedIn yet, I don't think.
No, very new. Bittersweet, don't get me wrong. DKSH is a company I work for, and I massively value the people that are there and the opportunity that they gave me. I've been very fortunate to be involved in some more business development side of things and some really good projects and things that I had put my hand up for. So I've got to do a lot in the 12 months, learn a lot, and got to meet some of the most beautiful people doing it. However, over that time, I've had other companies come to me and sort of poach me. I wasn't actively looking. I didn't have any desires to leave. But in very recent times, one of the big pharma companies, GSK, has come to me and offered me a position within their realm. Unfortunately, it's a bit of a competitor. So,
a bit.
So I've got to end that time with them, and purely because being with one company that doesn't offer the certain roles that I would like to sort of start looking down the sort of path of in those specialty roles where one does. And I think just overall in the career path, gaining those experiences in other areas where you can't get them is going to be far more beneficial. I'm a big advocate for getting experience where you can take it. You know, it's all going to come back around to eventually one day in your life, it's going to be worth it. I've come from many different career pathways, and here I am at about to be 36 in a week or two, and it's almost starting a new career. But everything that I've had has led to my ability to be able to do this and get these roles. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
They're lucky to have you, Mark, for sure.
Okay.
Do you think the fact that you had your DKSH role helped you get your GSK? Meaning, say you were, while you were, you know, during your injury and looking for a new role, if you'd applied for GKSH role, do you think that would have been harder to get because you didn't have any prior pharmaceutical industry experience?
To be honest, I have heard many times it's hard for, like, say, graduates and people coming into the industry really to get the experience and to get the jobs, which I empathise with to a degree. As I said before, I wouldn't get so disheartened if it's you straight out the gate and you haven't got the job straight away. I think the experience you can get anywhere is going to help. I don't know if I necessarily got the GSK job. I didn't apply for any of the big pharma companies to put that to the test. I only applied for DKSH because that popped up and we were like, oh, this looks great. Applied for it and had forgotten about it till they called me. I think my experience in the paramedic realm and having other jobs in the past, my ability to articulate in an interview and things like that, and my age helped me to get that role, or was the whole reason why I got that role. And then, gaining the experience there that was contracted to a big pharma company has then allowed me to open the door to actual big pharma. So I can't definitively say yes, because I don't know, because it never happened.
Yeah,
but I think it would definitely be one of the big contributing factors and probably the reason why.
What advice would you give to your younger self?
Don't stress. I was very much like, I still do. Don't get me wrong. I'm still a massive stress head, and ask my partner and whatnot. Everyone seems to want to have it figured out in high school. I wasn't an academic. I more played sports and then did a trade when I left school. But again, that taught me to be on time, to run projects, to talk to people, to get the work done, you know what I mean? And that led to then the fitness industry, where I had my own business where I had to sell the gym and then train my clients, put my time and effort into them whilst growing my knowledge and growing the business. I think I just tell myself not to worry, because everything I do, I'm going to gain, I'm going to learn something. Every career teaches you something, no matter what it is. And when it is that you find out what you want to do, which doesn't have to be today, doesn't have to be tomorrow, doesn't have to be 5 years from now, when you do figure out what it is that you actually want to do, you'll start realizing that everything that you did do has allowed you to do what you're doing now and helps you to have the experience that you thought you needed then, but you have now, and it comes at the right time.
I think that's great advice, especially nowadays. We live in such a fast-paced world where everybody's, you know, whatever it may be, we're just, it's such a hurry to get there. And
it is important. I think they need to have it figured out yesterday. Like, yeah, I just say relax, don't worry. If you don't get it today and you don't get it tomorrow, go do something else and come back to it when you've got more insight. And, you know, it'll all be okay.
I need to tell myself that more often. I'm 25 and I beat myself up when I don't get it right, even though, you know, and I just said, Lizzie, yeah, don't stress. It's okay. Yeah. It'll work itself out.
I'm saying it like it's easy, and I do that, but oh, I'm certainly exactly the same. I freak out day in and day out. So I need to remind myself to take my own advice.
Well, thanks, Mark. That's the end of my questions. It was great to have you on the podcast, listeners, and I hope you loved Mark's story. Really insightful, and it just shows that, you know, you can go down other avenues and eventually get to the pharmaceutical industry, for example, and try different avenues. So thanks for being on the podcast, Mark.
Well, thank you very much, Lizzie. Thank you very much for the opportunity for my story and for all your listeners out there. It's really awesome what you're trying to do and what you're trying to do for people and help them out. So well done to you, and thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date with new episodes, and feel free to leave me a review. See you next time.